This is Cut to It with Steve Smith Sr., a production of The Black Effect and iHeartRadio. I'm Steve Smith Sr.
And I'm Gerard Littlejohn.
And this is Cut to It.
Cut to it. Cut to it. Let's get down to it. Cut to it.
We ask the questions you always want to know, but no one ever asks.
Let's cut to it.
I should know it's on. You ain't heard about it, then we're about to let you know. I should know it's on. It's on.
I like to drive. I do not like to sit.
You don't like to sit?
No. I need to be moving.
Jeff Gordon, the retired driver of the number 24 car. He's a four-time NASCAR Cup Series champion, and he has the third most wins in NASCAR history. Right now, he's a Fox Sports analyst.
Let's talk ball. But, no football,
yeah,
no
same
basketball.
A stick and ball sport. Yeah. So,
so let's talk gears.
There you go.
So in talking these gears, we're going to be okay with showing the lack of understanding we have. And for the listeners, it may be dumb questions. But for
there's never a dumb question. I love educating
You got to school me and Smith on NASCAR.
But there are some dumb questions.
Yeah, yeah.
There really is. they're really –
just
used
imagine
–
imagine NASCAR 101, and you're the professor.
Yes.
Okay.
Here we go.
I'll try. I'm not a professor, but I told you how bad I was in school.
For us, you are.
Yeah.
I'll pretend.
PhD.
Sensei.
Yeah. Did you have a routine while driving? If so, what was that routine?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think a routine is so important.
But we're talking about driving a car, though.
Well, I'm probably talking about routine of prepping
see,
to get in the car.
That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah, I mean, to me, and you have to understand, and I'm a bit ignorant to you know what your day would have looked like on game day, but on race day, it's you're with sponsors and fans, and you know, you're interacting with all these different people from the time you get up in the morning on race day. That's just part of it, man. I mean, it's
that part's always crazy to me.
Hours.
I would be. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if it was hours, but you would go to 3 to 4 different hospitalities, suites, or you know, at the race hall or meeting 5, 10 people that were somehow connected to one of the sponsors on your car.
That's cool.
So you know, every morning so at first it was like, man, I can't believe I got to do all this stuff before I go get in the race car. But then it becomes part of your routine. You just got to get into the mental place of, I'm going to talk to these people, but like I'm talking, they're talking through me. Whatever
just
they're
nod
saying.
Just nodded and say yes.
Yeah, it was hard for it to actually penetrate because I'm thinking, okay.
Think about what you got to do.
I wonder what that car is going to feel like for, you know, turn one. Okay, we made these adjustments for practice. So the whole time I'm thinking about that, but I'm interacting. And I'm putting on a smile, and I'm shaking hands and taking pictures.
That takes skill by itself.
It took a long time to really get comfortable with doing that. And then you go to what they call the driver's meeting, which is basically a bunch of sponsors and you know, dignitaries or whatever that are there. You're really not there learning. It's not like they're saying, hey, here's how you're going to drive the race today. I mean, you already had that all figured out.
I hope so.
If we're trying to figure it out.
It's a day in a race. It's a day in a race. Come on. Hey, you know where the clutch is.
I thought it was a big left turn.
But what really became part of my routine later was from that moment, from the time you finally got away from all of the distractions, was I would go do a warm up, just, you know, and this is more when I got older, my body started failing on me, my back issues and things like that. But just I'd get on a bike, I'd warm up, do a few stretches, exercises, have somebody, you know, kind of push me a little bit, and then I would go get into my, you know, race uniform. But it was left leg, right leg, left sock, right sock.
Superstitious?
You could look at it that way. I think you could look at it that way. I didn't look at it that way, but I'm going to tell you what, right now, if my crew chief walked in and he's like, hey, man, what about, I'd be, put my, hang on one second. And go back.
No!
So I did not want to mess up the routine.
Gotcha.
You know, I wasn't about, like, lucky pennies and
anything
like
that.
Oh, like
a baseball player almost?
Yeah. I mean, some.
Like, or each.
Like a,
Like eat all your fries no matter what.
Yeah,
happens.
Yeah, like no, if you, I wasn't like that.
Like if you were a former pitcher, like Backstage Joe.
Backstage Joe is a former pitcher who they knew he would eat fries and they would do various things with those fries.
Oh, no.
And he still had to eat them.
He had to eat them all. Because, that is his thing.
You know, the fries had more to do than his actual velocity of arm strength. It was just the fries.
Of course, right? There's no skill involved.
No skill.
And now he has so much, you know, like post-traumatic that it carries over. And like we have to have certain meetings and we have to have certain post-games and
counseling.
All because of Backstage Joe.
So, yeah, man, that, you know, that became a place for me to just kind of get relaxed and ready.
So that routine in that superstition actually was a time for you to kind of reset to go, okay, we're done with the sponsorships. Now we're in race mode.
Yeah.
You still got to go out and do driver introductions.
Yeah, but so, I'm just saying
absolutely.
After driver introductions, it's on and popping.
The best thing that would happen was, and my wife would even tell you that, like when her and my kids were there, because you know NASCAR. That's a cool thing about NASCAR is you get to interact with them right until the time you get in the car. It's cool and it's not cool because you know you are in this game mode.
Get a little tightly wound.
Yeah, man, I'm wound up whether the day before went good or whatever our situation is. I could not wait to get in that car. I mean, like it could be 100 degrees outside. I'm sweating my butt off, but I'm like, get me in the car because I just want to get in there. And get the helmet on, get strapped in, and just truly get into that place. And that was, if I miss anything now that I'm not racing, it's those moments. Like you get in there in the anticipation of getting the green flag and going racing and competing against you know some of the best out there. That and with a great team and a great car, that was a cool thing to experience.
Talking about getting in the mind frame, I've always wanted to ask a guy. Especially because I know you've had some rivals. Now, I've watched you drivers sometimes, y'all. Hold me back. Man, I see you guys go after it. But I got to ask you, too, though. Like, have you, like, gotten to that fight mode where I'm a, and then you forget to unbuckle?
Let me unbuckle my seatbelt.
I'm a whoop his or you still got the harness? Harness!
We get made fun of because we leave our helmets on. Yeah, right? Like you get out of the car so fast.
There's been some football players who've been doing that the last couple fights
like,
too.
Man, if you're gonna get in a fight, you got to take your helmet off. It's like, I probably should. Yeah,
but I mean,
one time I flipped over, car was upside down, and especially in a stock car when it's upside down. You have an oil tank behind you, and there's hot oil pouring out of that thing, and you're going, I need to get the hell out of here.
Yeah, I'd say.
And so you're laying upside down, and you're like, okay, I know I shouldn't be taking my belts off, but I really want to get out of here. I bet I can get out of here. And you do it, bad mistake.
Why?
Because as soon as you unbuckle, you go straight to the roof, your whole body, you know, weight, and the belts have enough straps and things where usually it's going to catch on something. So now not only are you hanging, but you can't get undone. And it's scary. It's like, God, that wasn't very smart. And so I tipped over. It was slow roll at Daytona. It wasn't a bad accident, but it did go upside down. But I ended up upside down. And so I undid the belts. I was like, that was stupid. They finally got the car right side up, and I got the belts off of me. But I'd taken my gloves off. And that was the really big mistake because as I climbed out, I didn't realize the sheet metal had been all torn up and it just sliced my finger.
Wow.
So I get out of the car and they're like, oh, blood. You know, and immediately they're calling, you know, people over. I'm like, no, it's just my finger, man. I just cut my finger. It was not a great thing. It was embarrassing, but I was like, oh, yeah, leave the gloves on.
So what does a NASCAR rival mean to Jeff Gordon?
Well, it's funny. It means something different to me now. Right now that I do TV, I'm like, man, we need rivals.
Oh, yeah, it's
like,
good for business.
Yes. It's like I totally, when I was in it, when I was, you know, like I had a rival with Dale Earnhardt, and he played it up good. I mean, he was a master of that. And me, I was just like, I don't want to have anything to do with that. I just want to go out and do my job. I don't want to get distracted. He's just trying to mess with me and get in my head, get an advantage, or, you know, the media is gonna take something, and, mm-hmm. and then I'm gonna have to answer those questions and deal with it. I don't want to do that. I just want to race. And I wish I would have played into it a little bit more, because I realize, you know, that the fans, what they love so much is, they, like you mentioned earlier, they love to love somebody, they love to hate somebody, and they love it when there's a rivalry. Mm-hmm. It just builds more interest and gives people way more. The personal aspect of it, the human aspect of it, is sometimes more entertaining than the actual race. And we had a fight this past weekend on Saturday, not in the Sunday race, but the Saturday race. Man, that's all we showed on Sunday was these two guys swinging and going at it.
Did they land anything?
No, they swing and a miss, both of them.
Typical NASCAR fight.
The question is, was it intentionally a miss? You know, I mean, you connect with somebody, you're getting suspended. You probably won't be there the next week. If they see you make contact by throwing a fist, you can wreck a guy like I've done, unfortunately. Yeah. You can do a lot of things, but man, you can't swing and hit a guy.
So what about, would you get suspended for an open palm slap? Since you can't,
I love it.
Since you can't punch,
that's a good.
That's a smart way to get around. Especially if you still keep the helmet on,
like
you can still smack somebody hard enough, and then
well, there's like competitions, right? Slapping competitions, yeah. But you can shove. And you can talk smack, but I don't think you could hit them in any
form. No open palm. Open palm is disrespectful.
of course that's you'd right. say that.
I done backhand a few dudes in the locker room.
You backhand somebody in the locker room?
It's intentionally disrespectful.
Now hold on. In the locker room, you can do all you want.
So is it fighting in the?
Well, you got to understand the locker room. That's usually just like. The locker room to us would be like at the airport getting ready to leave.
Yeah, they don't really have a locker room.
Yeah, it's you know, you have your own individual trailer. But if somebody walked up into your trailer and punched you, or you punched them, that's.
So I want to revisit you backhanding people in your locker. Why would you backhand somebody?
I mean, you getting a little tussle with someone, and not gonna punch because if I'm punching, then it's, you know, we really into it. But open for me. The way I was right, open palm is all disrespectful.
But a backhand, that's like some old school, like, so I challenge you to a duel.
So hold on.
No,
so,
backhanding is...
So you wanted to show your disrespect, but you don't want to actually get into a real
No. So let me see. This is where you explain. You're missing. If I backhand you, I'm going to backhand it out of you.
Right.
So what comes next is when I backhand you, you're going to come back. And that's where you're going to catch that two-piece.
This is how you orchestrate NASCAR fights, Joe.
When you backhand by one, everybody goes, did he just backhand him? Yes, I did.
Is there like a player symposium?
And then here's the problem. When he realizes he got backhand, he's going to say, he hit me like a...
Right.
And then he's going to approach.
And then it's on.
Then it goes very quickly. Yeah, I'm backhanding a few people.
This is Smoke 101. Yeah.
First of all, if I backhand you, I have no respect for you.
Clearly.
No.
I mean, clearly.
No, I mean, zilch.
I don't really think that's a respectable type greeting. If you backhand someone, he respect the hell out of him.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah. I never thought of it that way.
But yeah, I never once thought it was like a warm greeting.
Because if I punch somebody, I might just be mad at them. It doesn't mean I disrespect them. But if I backhand you, I disrespect.
I'm out.
Quite an education here on backhand versus open palm versus.
Let me tell you something. Anytime you about to fight somebody and an open palm is done, it's not gonna go well. So, all right. So we've digressed, but really want to talk about, which I think is really cool. You've had 81 poles, which is unbelievable. What's the key to getting a pole, and when is the pole captured again, I know some of this stuff, but then I'm kind of like, I get the opportunity to talk to a great. And you have done and doing commentary and analyst work, but you also know exactly what these individuals are trying to accomplish.
Yeah, well, first let's establish there's no actual physical pole.
Thank you.
Yo, we may even have to start from the beginning. Someone case. May not even know what it is. Yeah,
so, and I think pole position goes back to like horse racing.
Oh, okay.
Where there's like, you know, the pole is the inside.
There's some other jobs that require pole, so I appreciate you clarifying that. You said it like that. Goes back to, I was like, yeah.
Right.
Horse racing. Oh, okay, cool.
Well, I think it may all come full circle in some forms, but you win enough bowls.
I see what you did there, Jeff. I see what you did there.
Well, isn't that very thoroughbredish of you?
I see what you did there.
But winning the pole position or being the fastest qualifier, I think, obviously, you know, the neat thing about racing is it's a team sport, but it's machine. The machine is the athlete, is the way I look at it, right? Like people debate whether race car drivers are athletes, and don't get me wrong, you got to be in very good physical shape, a different type of shape than say like you had to be for football, but you got to be in good shape. But the race car, that's what I want to be, the thoroughbred. Mm. I want that race car, you know, to have just a little more downforce, a little less drag, a little more horsepower, just a little more grip than anybody else out there. Now, if all things were equal, which they're not, I'm sorry, it's just not the case. It's just racing 101 the way it's been forever. Somebody's going to engineer something to make one car a little bit better than the next. And NASCAR does an excellent job at trying to create parity and all the different ways that they measure the car and inspect the car. Great job. But still, there's always going to be a way to try to get around that. And so, you know, on that day where you go to qualify, it's that machine and it's you, and you're just pushing it to the absolute limit of what that car is capable of doing. And, you know, if you do it right, then you're going to be the fastest one and you're going to win the pole position. And if you mess it up, you're either going to say, okay, I didn't get all of it, or the car wasn't capable of more than I got. And so I was, you know, I like to qualify. I loved being out there on that single lap, just pushing it. And I was always known to be a driver that drove, you know, what we say, deep into the corner. So, you know, there's a lift point at every racetrack. There's not Daytona or Talladega, but on all the other tracks, there's this lift point of where you get in there, you might use brake, not use brake, depending on the track and corner size and everything. And you just want to carry as much speed in there, but you really want to get back to the throttle and carry all the speed through the center and all back onto the next straightaway. So, you know, I love that challenge, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a purity of being a race car driver.
So why is the pole position so important?
Well, because a couple of things. One is it gives you the starting position to lead the field. You should be able to lead the field. You know, you're side by side, so there's a chance that you might not, but gives you the best opportunity. Plus, it allows you to get a better pit stall. So where your pit crew is going to do their work, if you're the pole position, or if you're number one on the grid, you get to pick where you want to be first.
Ooh.
So it has an advantage throughout the entire race.
And it seems like that's what it's all about, is what tiny advantage can you get every single time?
That's right.
My starting position, where my pit is, the modifications you make on your car. NASCAR is almost like a game of inches.
Well, and you know, we talk about clean air in racing, and what that means is if you're the first car, all the air that's seeing your car, you know, there's nothing disrupting it. It's seeing your car first. Okay, so it's attaching itself, giving you the best performance. Mm. As soon as you're the next one back, that air is doing all this. It's all just dancing all over the place. Yeah, so it's like getting in a jet wash of an airplane, and you know, they just. It's not going to attach itself to your car. And so you are already at a disadvantage. Mm. Now, if you're 5-10 cars back, like you got nothing. You got no air getting to your car.
Right? just random now, just made me think, do you believe NASCAR will transform, talking about Clean Air Act, talking about climate change? Just my thoughts when you said that. Do you believe NASCAR will transform itself into electric vehicle racing?
Well, one day they'll have to. I mean, you know, you know, I think NASCAR plans to be around for a long time. A lot of the race teams plan to be around for a long time. And you see where the future is going in, in automobiles. So it's happening now. You know, is it electric? Is it?
Because it's 30 minutes to charge, though.
But I'm just something that is
even more, a supercharge station is 30
I get what
minutes.
You're asking. It's something that's more sustainable, though.
Yeah, right. But
I wasn't asking like higher level. I was asking bare bones. Yeah, do you electric cars? Because
a lot of what we do is driven by the OEMs, right? Mm-hmm. And so if they're
OEMs, though.
Oh,
I said yeah, but I don't really think I know.
Basically,
what that
the manufacturer of the vehicle.
Oh, okay, you know? Okay.
So Chevrolet and Ford and Toyota or any other manufacturer that wants to come into NASCAR, if they say, listen, electric vehicles is our future. That's what we're going to be building. We need to find a path to introduce that to NASCAR. Wow. Then it's going to happen. I think there's already discussions about it, but I think that what you're going to see is similar to what we've seen in Formula One. Now, there's an all-electric Formula series out there right now. Huh. And what they do is they swap cars. It's crazy. So they start one car and run that thing till the battery's out. Come in and they get into another car. And then now I heard that this year they're going to have one car with one battery, but it's all about managing the power throughout the whole race. So, like, you might say, hey, right now I'm going to use 20% of my battery to pass these two cars ahead of me, but then I'm going to have 20% less later. Yeah. And right now I'm just talking about the one car. But yeah, this series, it's called Formula E. When they started, you had two cars because they couldn't run long enough.
I know.
Because it took so much power.
Because of the speed. Yeah. If you have the speed.
Exactly.
I have an electric car, so that's why I was asking.
Yeah. So what's going to happen, I think, and what we've seen in Formula One, where they introduce electric motor just for boost, right? Just for extra power, just to help the car accelerate off the corner. And now you're starting to see Ferraris and other cars that have Porsche, Ferrari, that has this in it that makes the car actually perform better. So you take a gas-powered engine and the electric power. I think that's what you're going to see NASCAR do initially. Whenever that time comes, they'll probably just have some kind of electric motor, and it might be a boost to pass, right? To that you get to use so much of it throughout the race. Like maybe it regenerates
the extra
itself.
Time, the extra you earn it, like in
not fan vote.
or you're like, hey, you got to win two replays overturn to get the third one.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of that. So I think it's going to – now, I will tell you this. If we ever go all electric, the thing I'm going to push the hardest for is that it's got to make some kind of sound, right? Like I don't want to hear the hissing and whistling of the drivetrain or the electric motor winding up. There's technology out there right now for electric vehicles, that make their own – amplified sound. Just make it sound cool, whatever it is. You know, if Chevrolet or Ford or Toyota says, okay, we're going all electric, no problem. But man, give me some cool sounding thing that when that car goes by, I'm like, I'm not going to say that's a V8. I'm going to say that's a kick-ass sounding car.
Yeah.
Just happens to be electric.
We have to take a break. And more than anything, we got to pay some bills.
Mm-hmm. You got to check.
I love Cut To It, and I love it even more when you download us and subscribe.
And you can follow us on social media too, Smitty.
Where at?
That's at Cut To It on Instagram.
What about Twitter?
At Cut To It.
Facebook?
Cut To It featuring Steve Smith Sr.
What about online?
And you can follow us at CutToItPodcast.com, where you can buy merch and you can subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts.
I got all my answers I got all my questions answered.
That's what I'm here for, brother. CutToItPodcast.com.
Mr. Cheeks, co-founder of the legendary hip-hop group Lost Boys. He's also a solo artist with 4 albums of his own, and he's a native of Jamaica, Queens, New York.
Not putting you on the spot of, downplaying
the one current versus the other.
Versus.
No question.
But listening to rap now, some artists, you can't tell between the chorus,
the hook, the bridge.
I can't separate it. Yeah. It's like it's all the same.
Nah, you 100% right.
Right, it's all like through the whole song.
It's not even a real 16 bars.
No, it's like two bars.
Yeah.
It's like the game got like, remember we used to have three verses in your records?
Yeah.
They don't do that no more. Niggas try to get away with one verse and slide off. And it's like, what happened?
You know what I'm saying? They're successfully doing it.
They winning.
Yeah.
They winning. Because niggas ain't got time to be listening to the whole stories no more. Niggas is just niggas like this now. Niggas want the bag. Niggas want everything so fast. Niggas forgot about what it is, though. Like, the game done changed so far that they fed these niggas, or they fed artists like, it's all about. The radio stations don't even give you, you know. How you going to wake up to them and taking your kid to school or whatever, and you hear a nigga talking about, I don't even know. I don't want to throw it out because I don't be really, I'll be hearing the records of the latest shit on the radio. y'all playing.
We have the same reaction.
It's my titty bar joint. What they doing, man? It's 8 o'clock, but nah. But it's different in the game.
Eight o'clock in the morning, they talking about. Yeah.
Right.
I'm like, yo, let's go. It's just different, man. The game is not the same, man. I mean, a lot of people that used to really care about the game, the execs and all of that, they don't care no more. They care about YouTube likes and all of that. It's not even about like talent no more. It's about likes and shit. Like the chick that glued her hair. If this bitch come out with a record, y'all niggas get out my face, man. I ain't doing it. If these niggas get this bitch that got the gorilla glue tapped to the head, y'all wildin', man.
But you know that's what happens because
that's people what I'm just saying.
Of them 15 minutes of fame.
That's how easy it is, man. Back in the days, we had to work for what we made, man. We had to work for, like right now, I worked for talking with y'all right now. I put my first record out in 1995. That's 2021. I'm talking to motherfucking Steve Smith, nigga. Yes, that. Big fans. You already know that. You know what I'm saying? Mad love to the fans. Shout out to G. I'm with y'all, man.
Whatever.
I'm cutting to it in 2021.
I think what you're saying is it's the longevity, right? Like Nas is still rapping. They have longevity. They still have the storytelling. They still have the history and paying homage to the game. Yeah. Right now, I hear exactly what you're saying, though. The point is, people are just taking advantage of that 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah. Hey, I ain't mad at it.
Microwave generation.
And the other part
hot
is...
pocket generation, nigga.
Yeah. Instant noodles.
Yeah.
Cup of noodles. But here's the thing, though. Then they get, and I'm not going to name a person, but they take 4 years and they save up. And they take all their money and they get a diamond impressed in their forehead.
Oh, man.
We just going
to... Some different shit.
He had to take
it. It's different, right? Yeah. It's different. Yeah. Man, you know, every time I see that, every time I see the homeboy with that in his head, man, I think about, you know, my man from the superhero shit, nigga pulled that shit out of his head, like,
oh, the Avengers,
yeah,
Avengers, like, yo, this nigga got the Avenger joint in his head. That's crazy. Niggas is putting Avenger joints in their heads. It's cool. Fuck it. I'm just rock these gold teeth, man. Smoke this weed.
The moral of that story is stick your own lane.
Oh man, yeah, niggas is rock stars. You gotta remember now.
I know, yeah. Hey, but here's the thing, though.
Because it's rock stars, baby.
Hey, don't leave no cabinet open and hit your forehead.
Oh. Don't leave no cabinet opening. Y'all think it's crazier than me. Let's go. I love it. Yeah.
Hey, he giggling because he'd have left a cabinet door open and forgot.
but he don't have a diamond in the middle of his forehead. There's a
goodness. Word. I want to know this. What happened to music videos? Man, I grew up watching Jukebox.
Oh man, or the basement.
Yeah.
Yo MTV Jams.
Yeah. Why are music videos gone?
Where them shows at, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know where those shows are either. But why? You used to make a song. When you did a song, you had to follow up with a music video.
Yeah.
Facts.
Because if your music video, sometimes a music video would show.
Yeah.
Your actual song. Like, that's how people
consumed it.
Yeah.
The visual.
Visual. Like, so how has it, I mean, if you don't mind breaking it down, like just really
how the game has changed.
The money. Like, because everyone thinks every rapper that has made it has that bag. And right. That's the case. There's a lot. I mean, you look at Toni Braxton. You look at some of these artists who have had multiple albums who've later come out and they say, hey,
I had a bad contract.
Or the deal was not what I thought it was. Yeah. Then you hear they weren't getting the bag. Yeah. And you hear some people, they talking about how, you know, going on tours, the way you make your money. I just want to know, like, how is it changing, how, you know, for the good and the bad, and why is all this stuff, everybody think, like football, there's 53 guys on the roster.
Right.
But there are really only about 12 guys making buku. Mm-hmm. Then the other 40-something of them, they doing all right. You know, they're doctors and lawyers, but they aren't
right
multimillionaires that people assume they are. Mm-hmm.
Now with niggas it's a different game, brother. You know what I'm saying? Like, when we was in the game, we had to go to labels and get deals and fight for it, and you know. Now, like I said, it's like, they're just giving out the money right now. Whatever sticks to the wall, bang, you know? That's what I look at. I ain't even mad at saying that shit.
But when you say they giving money, you know, not
giving money away.
Not using yourself as the example, but
now you can use me as an example.
I'm saying
I made bad mistakes.
No, I'm just talking about as far as like you saying they're giving money away. What's a lucrative deal that you're hearing that's out there?
Oh, they lucrative deals. They got the 360s going on. You feel me?
No, I don't know what.
Well, yeah, explain to us what a 360 deal is.
You asked me, and I'm feeling you.
They're taking all your show money, they're giving you the biggest shows because they're taking some of that money. I mean, it's just what it is. They give you budgets because they're getting their money at the see what the records do, you know? Like it always been. But I really ain't been in the industry, so I ain't really been in the game. I got my own label and all that. I know my own little routes that I'm taking the way to sell records and all of that. So it's like, I'm how can I explain? I really like, when they giving out these deals now, it's 360. When they say 360, like I said, they taking most of the, it's really like not your career.
They take it.
When you do shows, you don't give your label the money. You know what I'm saying? When you sell the merchandise, you don't get your label. The label don't get that money.
Yours.
That's supposed to be you all day. Like, but now they got the, like I said, three. You might have to talk to somebody else that know about the 360. But like I said, I ain't been in the game in about what the industry. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I've been in my own runs, doing my own thing, my own still popping, but. It ain't really like with a label and all of that. It's only my own label and my own, you know, my own backing since when we's doing it. So, but it's just like, yo, the game is just mad different right now. I can't really explain it because I ain't really playing that game with them no more, you know? But like I said,
would you say that guys are in the rap game right now, not everybody? You know, we're not talking about the Drakes. We're not talking about the Kendrick Lamars. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about the big guys. We're talking about the middle of the road guys.
Right.
They looking apart, but it doesn't always equal up to the part.
Facts. A lot of lying going on. A lot of front. A lot of bullshit. A lot of clout chase. We get it. But sometimes you got to fake it to make it, you know? That's the bull.
So how long, based off what you've experienced, guys that you hung around with or guys that you've seen or you battled up against that you realize even back then they was clout chasing, but in the end they lost? Like, how you what you know, and the reason I say that is in not naming.
No, people, I got exactly what you're saying.
Because
I'm spending money on their trash ass music and front like they balling and their records ain't selling. So then they ain't really getting the bag. They're just spending the bag that they got from the whatever they got it from. So I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like, niggas can front all day. They give me 100,000. I'm a front hard body. Do what I got to do. But if my record don't sell and the shit don't really pop off, I mean, the excitement is popping. You know what I'm saying? If I ain't really making it happen to get that money back, I mean, it was all worth nothing. You know what I'm saying? Like, you see what I'm saying? Like, a nigga loan me some money to do what I got to do, but I don't come through from him giving me that money, but I was fronting like I was having it and doing it like bing, bitty, bing, and it didn't really turn out that way. Mm. Now I'm sitting on the shelf looking crazy, yeah. Right? You understand what I'm saying?
No,
so,
I got you.
Niggas that be fronting with the bag, I don't know. I can't really talk for that nigga, you know?
Yeah, no, I just,
a lot of niggas that be doing that shit.
Yeah, it's just every... There's so much music out there.
Yeah.
It's really hard to know who's successful and who's not.
And I was going to say, now the way that you consume and the way that it's put out, like this, the whole streaming platforms, it's a lot to choose from. But then I think also what both of y'all are saying is it seems like that's changed the game too. Like
Has streaming be good or bad for the music industry?
Like you said, it's both ways, man. You know, it's good. That's good for me. I'm an old school nigga. You know what I'm saying? Sony, what they got, the iTunes, they got the Spotify, you know, we use all of that. But yeah, I guess it's good. But then it's also bad because, goddamn, man, you get anybody could sell a record, kid. You know? I don't know, man. I ain't no real like music nigga that be hating on niggas' music.
No, I'm just asking. I'm not asking.
I'm
asking because you. I just going back in the day. First of all, get popped upside the head if you order more than one jukebox.
Was that like the music video? The mail thing?
No, jukebox was
like
back in the days
for
back in the day. Jukebox for Cali dudes was you watch television. And you can, for 99 cent or $2.99, if it was a feature, you call in and you request
the box.
Yeah.
That music video or that song.
Gotcha.
Right?
Yep.
And that's how they do it. Now with streaming, you just
on your phone.
You just download it.
Right.
You pay.
It's already there.
You pay $19.99 or whatever the case may be, and you can download
whatever
you want. Yep. And if it's a feature, and it just comes out, you could download it early, you know, pay for it. And I just see that things are different.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so being an old school cat, you that have had number of records, when somebody downloads it, yours, you get the residual, but you capture, back in the day, you were able to capture that information.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Now, it seems like it seems like it's harder to understand how they capture it.
Oh, yeah. Because there's a lot of wiggle room.
It's so much. With that $20 a month, I can download as much as I want.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You got Peloton, right? I get on the Peloton, I'm running the whatever.
Right.
Right?
No doubt.
It just seems as music has still stayed the same with expression.
Yeah.
The way you can consume it around the world is different.
Right.
Hell yeah.
Right. It's all the streams, man. And the question becomes, what is the cost of a stream? And that's an open-ended question, but it goes back to, from an artist perspective, like Mr. Cheeks is talking about, like, I'm sure you knew back in the day, all right, I'm selling the CD, I get a cut of the CD. But now it is very different in the means of the streaming has just changed the way that people consume and the way that people purchase.
Yes, it's a crazy game, brothers. You know, I just remember, when you could buy an album. Remember, you could buy an album, really enjoy an album. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? No fat. You don't fast forward no records.
Man.
No.
Remember those days?
Lost art form too.
Yeah.
It's a lot lost, man. But it's still out there though. Don't get it twisted, cause there's some good artists that still got albums out. Like You know, Sheik Loon got a new album out. Sheik Loon. Royal Flush has got his 25th anniversary. Underground shit, I love so much. You know what I'm saying? So I just want to shout that out, shout those out.
Is underground still is prominent as it is?
Hip-hop is coming back, man. I mean, like, you know, it's every time. It's like a circle of things that go down.
Yeah.
And the boom back is on his way back. The boom back is on his
heavy
way back.
Heavy air stuff, yeah.
Yo, check this out. My man, you know, Brucey B. Yeah, the original, you know, from Wild Style and all that. Mm-hmm. Brucey B. I mean, not Brucey B, Busy B.
Yeah.
It's cool, Busy B. He got a record out right now that they ain't really paying attention to it, but it's so hard. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like we don't really pay attention to, you know what I'm saying, music like we used to, because it's not really out there for us to get or to hear, because they're so flooded with everything else right now. You know what I'm saying? It's like
very
took away from the real, the classic ways of making music and really putting in that work and them tracks from Pete Rock and, you know what I'm saying? Like, oh man, oh shit. But I don't mean to jump off the course, but yeah, I miss music like that. And it's on its way back though. Trust me, man. I mean, like.
When you were growing up talking about music on its way back, how thick was the East Coast versus West Coast?
Mm. Say it again?
How thick and legitimate was the East Coast versus West Coast beef?
How thick was it?
Yeah, because you know sometimes people be like, it wasn't legit. It was just all for. It was just all for. It was all for show.
It wasn't all for show because two niggas died, right? Man, that shit wasn't no show. Shit was real.
Yeah.
But it was a real beef. I mean, it wasn't really like no really our beef. I mean, but we was back in Biggie because he was on the East Coast and the niggas that was with Tupac was back in Pac over there. I mean. But you know, let me tell you the beautiful thing about that East Coast, West Coast beef. Me and the motherfucking Dog Pound shot Music Made Me High remix out in L.A. together, East Coast, West Coast, while that beef was going on. You know what I'm saying? So it wasn't really like, it was like Diddy and Shug shit, nigga. And a lot of people got caught between that shit. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm not saying it like that, but I'm saying it.
But you're saying it.
That's what life was, man. It's a lot of other shit. Not the main characters. Biggie and Tupac beef. They had the music going on, but other elements came about, you know?
But it seemed like because of the beef that the realness and the hard work, East Coast tried to outwork West Coast. West Coast tried to outwork.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The music was so direct,
yeah,
but also so original, so creative. Because whatever you came out with, the that side of the coast had to come back.
Yeah, they had to come back with something
with
else.
More substance.
And then it birthed more. Because like Mr. Cheeks is saying too, like. Think they were able to merge them and the Dog Pound were able to merge, and then later on, then you got the South rising up, right? Like you got Outkast came into the fold. Right. So even having that, but still you were able to birth other projects and other places from the country, able to bring about good music as well.
That's a fact. I mean, you look at that, like when East Coast and West Coast is beefing, motherfucking the AT aliens came and all of that shit.
That shoulder.
See, I'm from North Carolina. I remember all of that.
You know what I'm saying?
Miss Jackson.
Miss Jackson, yeah.
Miss Parker was on Friday. Miss Parker was on
Friday. Hello, Miss Parker.
I think it's about that time. Just take a little breather.
Cut to it. Cut to it. Let's get down to it.
Hey, Gerard, where did you get that t-shirt?
You mean this thing?
Oh, yes.
I got it from cuttoitpodcast.com, where we have exclusive merchandise. Shout out to our guys at 704 Shop. But yeah, you can go on, buy you a t-shirt, subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts.
Muggsy Bogues, he's not just the shortest player to ever play in the NBA. He's a 14-year veteran, most notably with the Charlotte Hornets, first-time All-ACC at Wake Forest, and overall great an iconic legend in the NBA.
Let's talk ball. And again, you were the 12th overall pick with the Washington Bullets. Then you were traded a year later. When you were drafted, you had dreams and goals and aspirations. At what point in your career of your first year that you realized that there were some goals and aspirations that were just kid dreams. Mm. And then you realize that, you know, you have an opportunity to do something that you've dreamed about, you know, fantasized about, that it was really in your grasp to do.
Mm. Well, I think, you know, my first year with the Bullocks, you know, you come there with a lot of expectations, a lot of goals. You know, you're being drafted. You want to be the rookie of the year. You want to make sure that, you know, you're among the top among still. You want to make, you know, you just have certain personal goals that, you know, that you set for yourself, because those are the things that you know you're capable of doing. During the course of the season, we had a coaching change. And that kind of changed a little bit of some of my playing time and the way they was, the style of play, how they wanted to play. And then I realized, you know, it may not happen this year with some of the goals that I had, you know, floating in my head. But at the same time, you know, you can't lose that confidence within yourself, because, you know, once that happened, you know, that really takes control of, you know, all your, you know, your body for your the way you play, the way you act and all that stuff. So the confidence always stayed at the forefront. It was just a matter of waiting for the right opportunity to showcase it. And I knew during the end of the first year with the Bullets, things were starting to change. You know, things were starting to kind of, you know, not be the way I had envisioned. Then we go into the playoff, and then my minutes is cut a little more during the playoff, and I kind of, you know, start to wonder what was going on. But again, after we take, you know, Detroit to five games, that's where it was, the best out of five then. After the meeting, I felt like, you know, things were still good. You know, things was good after we had that exit meeting. But then again, now in hindsight, knowing that it wasn't, it was just a, you know, fuck what they were saying. You know, I just, it just kind of messed with your head a little bit, but I never lost my confidence though. It was just a matter of waiting for that right opportunity. And then even coming down here in Charlotte, you know, still faced with the same situation with Dick Harter, you know, being, you know, not believing in the small guard, still had that hang up on, I need a taller, bigger guard. And, you know, one incident, he actually went in George Shinn's office. And, you know, this was George Shinn had told me, he actually went in George Shinn's office. And, you know, George Shinn is not tall himself. You know, George ain't about 5'5", 5'6" himself. So the coach happened to go into the office, and he gets down on his knees and put his arms up to George Shinn and say, "George, this is what I'm faced with every night when I play Muggsy." And George Shinn kind of looked at him like, "Really? He actually, you're going to get on your knees and you do this to me in front of me about Muggsy?" And Lord knows, of course, we was in San Antonio. Of course, Dick Harter got fired right afterwards. And then when Gene Littles took over, then that's when, you know, that's when I started to really, you know, excel and become, you know, the player that I wanted to become.
Did you have any superstitions while you were playing?
No, I didn't really have any superstitions. You know, a lot of guys, some guys had superstition. For me, it wasn't. I ain't had no rituals that I did, you know, because everything kind of came spontaneous for me, you know. But I always, of course, I got to the game at the right time. I always got to the game at a certain time. And I always kind of had a little routine where I stayed in the locker room and made sure that I ain't come out the locker room until 6:15, you know, to do my little warm-ups, because I knew that the little kids and everybody was going to be out there lined up. And I wanted to make sure that I get an opportunity to make sure I greet them to go shoot and then come on back before the 6:30, you know, for the time to go out for 6:30. So that was the only, you know, that was the only thing I really did. I ain't had no particular rituals that I did.
Do you believe the game has changed? And if so, How has it changed?
Well, it definitely has changed. And you know what? And in all honesty, I kind of like the way the game is. And every era has its way of a way of play. Yeah. You know, even back in the 60s and the 70s, you know, those guys were more of a, it was a slower paced type of game, more cutting, more passing, you know. The game has evolved so much, you know, back in my era, you know, in the 80s. I mean, you know, we had guys, you know, they have 7-footers, you know, they play with their back towards the basket. Mm-hmm. You know, today's game, we got the 7-footer, you know, they facing the basket, bring the ball up the court. And, yeah. you know, the emphasis on the 3-point shot is a lot more. You got a lot more, the court is spread open a lot than what it was for us. You know, it was more packed it in where the guys could camp in the lane a lot. We could hand check. It was a more physical when we play. You know, it's not as physical as it is today, but, you know, that's all have to do with the scoring, you know, the excitement of the game, the fast pace of the game. And so you get to see, you know, the skill sets of the players, you know, which is what's remarkable today, you know, seeing a guy like LeBron, you know, in his 17th year, still being able to, you know, put up the numbers that he's able to do and still be productive. I mean, the game has changed and allow these guys to play a lot longer, I should say, today.
We always, you know, you hear this debate now, especially me being in the media. At times you hear this GOAT debate. You know, why has this topic of discussion come up so much?
I have no idea, Smitty. I really don't, man, because, you know, you're talking about the GOAT. I mean, everybody's played the game and impacted, you know, totally different. You look at Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Magic. Magic is my guy, you know, Magic. And, you know, the MJ and LeBron. But the thing about what I say about all this is that when I look at a player, an athlete, and only guy that I see as polished as he was and had no deficiency in his game was MJ. And that's where it separates from, because when you got the fundamentals aspect of the game and then the athletic ability, but to the point to where, you know, you can, it's off the charts with his athletic ability. I mean, it was breathtaking to see it. And it wasn't that he did it on one end of the court. He did it on both ends of the court. You know, he was 9-time defensive champion, as well as the killer instinct that he had. But just the bottom line, just, you know, it just that, you know, everybody, every player has some sort of deficiency in their game. Every player. Every player have some sort, even, you know, I take them from LeBron and Kobe, everybody has some sort of deficiency. MJ was the only guy that was able to perfect his deficiency that he had when he first came into the league. And that was just his shooting a little bit to where he increased it to the range that where it was 3-point. And then once that happened, it was, you know, it was no way you can stop it.
Six rings after that.
Yeah. 6 rings after that. But, you know, people don't understand. It's the way the way MJ had that killer instinct. It was like, you know, you knew two men was going to try to stop him. He was able to create space and still make that play, you know, and he never shied away from making that play. And that's the thing that stands out about him when reminisce with a lot of guys, because, you know, you look at LeBron will make a play, you know, and sometimes he would shy away from that moment. And, you know, and it's nothing knock on him. It's just he's looking at the game the way he see it and how he feel like, you know, he can impact it. In my time, it might be a pass. It might be a shot. Who knows? You know, but MJ, you always knew it was going to be a shot unless 3-4 came in double team. And he kick it out to Steve Kerr to make the shot. But other than that, you know, all of them the GOAT for me, man. That GOAT stuff is kind of crazy. You know, they're always some heck of a basketball players. And, you know, they all kind of, within their own right, the best at it.
You are. a unique person. You are well worth it. You are competent. And most of all, you're lovable. I'm Steve Smith Sr.
I'm Gerard Littlejohn.
And this is Cut to It.
Cut to It with Steve Smith Sr. That is me. Is a production of Cut to It LLC, Balto Creative Media, The Black Effect, and iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
From Cut to It, executive producer Steve Smith Sr., co-host Gerard Littlejohn, talent and booking manager Joe Fushi, social media team Wesley Robinson and John Show. From Balto Creative Media, Cut to It is produced by Brian Baltashevich and Meredith Carter, with production assistance by Alex Labreck, production coordinator Taylor Robinson. Theme music by Alex Johnson, lyrics and vocals by Anthony Hamilton. You ain't heard about